Tokyo Podcast episode number 34.
On today's show, I talked to longtime resident of Japan, Ruth Jarman Shiraishi, about her first book titled Nihonjin ga Sekai ni Hokoreru 33 no Koto. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe. And I am back in Tokyo after spending a week down in Fukuoka. And what a gorgeous little city that Fukuoka is, eh? I never been there before. And it was very interesting for me to see another city here in Japan. Fukuoka is a very compact city, but it has lots of wide open space. I noticed that the architecture is a little bit different down there too. I find that many of the office buildings here in Tokyo, I guess probably due to earthquake regulation, are very similar looking. They're just kind of this boring box. But I noticed that many of the buildings down there had some art sculpture in it and had a little bit more distinctive look to them. And the city itself is very nice. It's very, very close to the ocean. And I think there's mountains down there as well. And it has kind of a very cosmopolitan feel to it, but nowhere near as busy as Tokyo. So I really enjoyed my time down in Fukuoka. And I think if anybody is coming to Japan and you like to, you know, get out of the typical Tokyo, Kyoto, Osaka route, I highly recommend going down to Fukuoka and checking it out, because I had a lot of fun down there. I was down there filming for a company called Gogo Nihon. And Gogo Nihon is a Tokyo-based company that helps international students come to Japan and study Japanese. They have partnered with a wide variety of schools all across Japan. And we were down there doing some promotional video work for two new schools that they've added to Fukuoka. And so I will have a full interview with the owner of Gogo Nihon at a later date. But if you're interested in coming to Japan and studying Japanese, I would definitely recommend checking out gogonihon.com. And if you're coming to Japan on holiday, I would also highly recommend going down to Fukuoka, because it is a really, really fantastic city. Ruth Jarman Shiraishi is a longtime resident of Japan and is the CEO of Jarman International, which focuses on business development for 9 unique partner companies ranging from real estate to financial services to eco-friendly energy to publishing. Ruth is the first Western woman to hold a Japanese real estate license here in Japan and has spent the last 20 years working in and with Japanese companies. She has recently combined her knowledge of Japanese business with her love for Japan to produce her first book, and I'm very pleased to welcome Ruth Jarman Shiraishi to Tokyo Podcast. Hey, Ruth, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, I am a huge fan of your Facebook wall.
Thank you.
Because you seem to absolutely love Japan, don't you?
I do.
How long have you been here?
I've been here 24 years.
Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah.
And just quickly, what brought you to Japan originally?
Well, I grew up in Hawaii, so I always had kind of an affinity for Japan. Because in Hawaii, you know, if you're what they call hapa haole, you're mixed Japanese and Caucasian, you're usually the most popular kid in the school. So everybody likes you a lot. And I am not like that. I'm full-on haole, full-on Caucasian, so I was always like, ina, thinking like that about anything about Japan was very cool, right, when I was in Hawaii.
Right.
And a lot of my friends who were hapa haole would come here and model and things like that, and I always thought, wow. And everybody would bring back magazines from Japan with them, you know, modeling in it, and we all thought it was so cool, and, you know, Japan is like so way ahead of the world, and you know, we just had such a good opinion of Japan. Also, Japanese tourists were like, you know, the treasure trove for anyone in Hawaii, because it's basically the whole industry is tourism, right?
Right.
So if you go to any hotels in Waikiki, you would see kanji everywhere. You would hear a lot of Japanese. The second language that everybody took in high school was Japanese. So I was very accustomed to Japanese to start with. Then I went to university and was studying international relations. And within that major, you have to master a language to a certain degree. So they really force you kind of off campus in your junior year. And I came to Nanzan University in Nagoya. Yeah. So I studied Japanese. Wonderful host family experience there. And I just actually felt more comfortable in Japan than I had felt in Boston.
Really?
Yeah. I think it's because of the background of Hawaii.
Right.
So, you know, coming from Hawaii, it's easier to fit into Japan just because there's so much about Japan that's very strong in Hawaii.
Right.
As opposed to going to, you know, the East Coast where it's a very different place.
Yeah. So you came to Japan kind of near the end of the bubble, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Right? And started working for Japanese companies. What was that like for you being a Western woman working with Japanese company?
Well, I mean, luckily, you know, after writing this book and, you know, writing the book made me really dissect everything about my experience here. And I think that I've noticed a lot of other people from Hawaii, like Konishiki, Musashimaru, you know, the sumo guys. I know a lot of people from Hawaii and Japan. And it seems like we have a tendency to meld a bit better with Japan. So when I entered the company, I felt extremely overwhelmed, as everyone else would, because there was nothing to do with English with my job.
Right.
But on the other hand, I didn't really have any specific expectations for like my career from day one. So I think in Hawaii, we're kind of used to sort of blending, like practicing blending with the situation you're in. And so instead of saying, well, what about me? How come you guys are not taking care of me? And you should be telling me what my career plan is going to be for the next 5 years, you know, from day one. It's sort of like, oh, you know, like go with the flow kind of attitude. Right. It's like, ah, okay. I don't understand anything on my desk. Like, I don't even know how to write my name in katakana. I was asking the guy next to me how to write my name. It was like the absolute worst Shinjin you could ever have. She doesn't even know how to write her name.
Yeah, I remember when I first came here and I was actually filling out the rental application and they asked me to write my name in katakana. And that really threw me because I was like, what?
What? How?
How do I write my own name? I never experienced that before. I'm like, Ansoni. How do I write that, you know?
Yeah, so you come from a background where you're pretty much fluent in your first language, right? In English, okay? Then you realize you have to change everything. Every single vocabulary word you know has to be now switched into a different language. So it's the first time in your life you feel such a handicap. So you have all these smart people around you, and that's when you start feeling really dumb. You just feel like a baby. And these guys who are around you don't speak two languages, or they've never had an international experience. So they have absolutely no sympathy for your situation. They just look at you like, are you stupid? You know?
So and you do feel stupid, you know. You lose so much of your independence when you move to a new country.
Oh my gosh. I mean the first experience, they just took me over to a regular, you know, kind of like a dorm, like a company dorm for the new employees. There's nothing in the room. I mean, it's a nice little room. It's a good location. But there's nothing. There's no coffee maker. There's no bed. There's no nothing. And I have no idea where to shop. Like, where to go. Like, where do you get a bed in Japan?
Right.
I didn't know.
Right.
So then I only had like $1,000 to start with, which was a lot of money for me. Mm. Right? And then you don't get paid till the end of the month. And then the lady who came and took me to the apartment said, okay, I'll go get you a futon, you know? And I was like, okay, onegaishimasu, could I at least speak Japanese? So she goes to the department store, gets a futon, it's a nice set, you know, this is bubble, right? And she's like, oh yeah, it was only, you know, yomayen, which is $400, which is just less than half of what I brought for the first month. And I'm like, oh no. So I had to go to the recruit head office. Like, I think it was like after 3 weeks, and I said, I don't have any money. Can you please give me money? So they gave me an advance. That was so nice.
You talk a lot about Hiromasa Ezoe-san and the positive impact that he's had on your life.
Yes.
you know, going to recruit the first time and not being able to write your name and not knowing how to answer the phone, all this kind of stuff. Can you talk about how he helped you go from that stage of your career to, you know, being successful in the company and really growing to have this, you know, influence in Japan?
It's easy. He just gave me confidence. I think that's what that's the answer to everything. But so many managers are unable to do that to people that work for them. For some reason, in a manager situation, we start to look, and just like in a marriage, you know, you start to notice the negative sides of your spouse or your partner or your people that work for you. And as humans, we tend to point out the negative side. What Ezoe-san did for me is he refused to look at my negative side. He never mentioned it. I mean, obviously, I know I have so many ways to improve. But he knew that I understand that I'm not good enough yet. So he would look for the good in me. And he would call me at like 10:30 at night when I'm still in the office and be like, Lucy ga inai to kono kaisha wa naritatanai ndayo. Like, if you're not here, this company's like doomed, you know? He would say, oh, everything is thanks to you. And, you know, thank you for all that you're doing. And you're great. And, you know, keep going exactly what you're doing. And you're awesome. And when I would say things, you know, like say an opinion or whatever, he'd be like, that's right. You know, clap his hands and point at me and say, that's exactly right, you know. And then when he started doing that for me, I started, everything that came out of his mouth is something that I would agree with 100%. So he gave me so much assurance that what I was thinking about managing a company or, you know, vision for how it should grow or how to treat people or handle people, maybe the way that we think is a little bit similar, but everything he said, I was like, that's right, you know. And I had always thought it was something wrong with my Japanese or something wrong with me as an individual or I can't communicate well or something. That why people always say, no, no, you can't do that. No, you can't do that. But then I realized, wait a minute, maybe I'm one of those big thinkers. Like I think about big things and I like to do them. I like to have it. I like to get it done. You know, if you're going to do something big, why not try? You know, you aim for the stars and you reach the moon. I mean, what's wrong with that, right?
Right.
So he was also like that. And so he would always say, that's right. Yes, that's right. And that was what it, I mean, that's been 20 years that he's been doing that for me, you know, at various stages along the way.
Do you think that, I mean, it was pretty interesting that he had this vision of internationalizing his Japanese company many, many years ago, when if you look at a lot of Japanese companies now, they seem to be struggling with that.
This, right.
Globalization seemed to have really hit Japan and caught Japan Inc. off guard.
Thank you for saying that. That's exactly what I've been saying. It's like it's fallen from the sky.
Right.
And it's because of the earthquake, because of the supply chain problem. All of a sudden, we realize that if the supply chain in the little, you know, industries in the Tohoku area, some of those little tiny pieces that are couldn't be made. And it actually stopped the assembly line in the U.S., right, for a little while. So they realized suddenly, oh, my gosh, we can't have everything in Japan anymore. So we have to put some stuff in Thailand. We have to put some stuff here, whatever. And then now everybody's like, oh, no, we really have to globalize now.
Yeah, because it's pretty, you know, revolutionary for him way back when to think about modernizing his company and westernizing his company by putting all these foreigners in it. And you kind of think that if more companies had done that back then, Japan might not be in as much trouble as they are now.
True.
Do you think that other companies kind of looking to his example and doing the same thing now?
I don't think they're looking at his example, but as I said earlier, the people that have worked in Recruit since then are all influenced by him. And the average amount of time somebody works at Recruit maybe is about 5 or 6 years. So Recruit is kind of like a producer of entrepreneurs. That's what Ezoe-san wanted it to be all along. He wanted to keep Recruit itself very young, average age, you know, 26, 27. And he wanted that as soon as somebody reaches 30 or 32, that they would leave the company and start their own company. So he always gave like really big bonuses for people that left, you know, early on and stuff so that they would have like, you know, $100,000 to start a company up and things like that. And the people that are hired in Recruit are all very entrepreneurial-minded people. So I think people would not necessarily point back and say, oh, this is from Ezoi-san. But they will say, the people that have graduated from Recruit, the people that were influenced by Ezoi-san, are now literally changing Japan. So Mikitani-san at Rakuten, Yanai-san at Fast Retailing, you know, Son-san at SoftBank, they all, I mean, this is kind of, I guess it's okay to say, but I'm sure that they've all spoken with Ezoi-san. Like, they've had lunch with him, things like that. So he's kind of like the mentor for everybody who's trying to push the envelope, make change happen.
Yeah, I can just imagine him bringing you into his company. It must be like a tornado going through, like, you know, a neighborhood or something, because your personality is so much larger, let's say, than most Japanese people, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's... Imagine the poor little Japanese office staff, like, oh, great, we're getting this foreigner. This is going to be interesting. You show up, hey, guys, how's it going?
No, that's what you think, right?
Right.
It wasn't like that. That's why I have such a different opinion of Japan than any other foreigner I've ever met.
Really?
Because my voice was not even able to be heard in the general affairs of Recruit at the time.
Really?
Those guys were so loud and so crazy. And it's like, they're all coming in the morning and like, Ohayou gozaimasu, otsukaresamadesu, you know, like that in the morning. And it was just, in the morning we had this thing called kakegoe, which you have a morning meeting. And they're like, okay, so-and-so, you know, what are you doing today? And why are you not speaking loud? You have to speak louder, you know. And the person be like, okay, today I'm going to do this. And this is what I'm planning to do. And we're going to go and do that. And everybody be like, okay, gosh, good, gosh, like that. And then at the end, it'd be like, okay, you know, Sato-san, today you're the kakegoe, kakegoe. And so Sato-san would go way back to the back of the room, like on the floor of the building,
right,
and run from the back of the room and say, Kyō mo ichinichi ganbaru za! And everybody in the room would go, oh, like that, you know? And we would start. And I was like, okay, I found my place. This is where I was meant to be. This is more, it was like everybody in the whole room was a cheerleader. That's what
right.
It felt like.
Right.
Much
wow.
more genki, much more forward-thinking, much more welcoming of different people than any situation I'd ever been in the U.S.
Wow, interesting. Huh. So I would have thought it was the opposite.
So that was my impression of Japanese people. So for 4 years, I was in a situation where we're walking through Ginza in our cheerleading outfits, you know, with a... mascot head on one of those push, you know, daishas,
right,
because
right.
we have to take the mascot to the other building, you know? And people are like, what are they doing, you know? Just absolutely, it was like a fraternity house with really smart, very aggressive, energetic, intelligent people. And so that was my basis for my corporate experience in Japan. That was the first 4 years. So I got my entire opinion of Japanese people off of those people. So when people say, yeah, but Japanese people are shy and it's a, you know, it's an island nation and we can't do that. And no, I'm not very good at English. And I'm like, come on, you know, that's not the Japanese person I know, you know, I know you can do it.
It must have been a bit strange for you, though, to go from 4 years of that company to some of these other Japanese companies that weren't like that same atmosphere.
Yeah, but it was like, I knew what they can
do. You knew the secret, right?
I knew. It's like, uh-huh. You're trying to act all conservative and, you know, shy with me. But I know. I know it's in there. It just needs to be released. You know, because everybody in Japan wants harmony, which is one of the strengths of this company. So, this country. So, you want harmony. So all you have to do is create entrepreneurial viewpoint harmony. And then everyone will want that. So it's not really that hard. Everybody is so good at doing awaseru to everyone else that once you start to infuse this country with a sense of globalization, like you said, globalization is falling down from the sky, it will also happen that quickly. Because everybody is so attuned to each other.
Let me ask you kind of, maybe this is a strange question, but, you know, me being so new here.
Yeah?
I do see that. I do see that this company or this country is, you know, falling behind a little bit compared to, say, China or some of these other countries. And it would seem that Japan is searching for a leader or someone who they can fall in with to gain some of this globalization. Where do you think that leadership is going to come from? Is it going to come from some entrepreneur like Izoe-san? Is it going to come from a politician? Where do you, you've been here a long time. You've been in the corporate world a long time. Where do you think that's going to come from?
I think it's going to come from multiple sources, just because this country is not, I mean, as you know, the more you live here, you realize, I mean, the whole society isn't really set up to have, after the war, everybody got afraid of one person being in charge, right?
Right.
Or a couple of people being in charge. So they seriously, I mean, constitutionally made it impossible for one person to be leader here, which is a good thing. So it's kind of like the UK where you have the parliamentary system, right? So here it's more, and then after the earthquake, people have realized, wait a minute, not only do we not really lean on one leader in the government, but wait a minute, the government might exactly not know 100% what's going on, right? They might be a bit out of touch with what's going on in the areas. So that's why all these localities have said, yeah, we're not turning back on our nuclear power plant, sorry, you know? And up until now, if the central government said, yes, you are turning it on, they would be like, the mayor or somebody would say, okay, understood. But now what they're doing, I mean, at least from my impression, I mean, I don't have any inside knowledge or anything. My impression is the mayors, of course, are towing the line because they have to. So they're saying, oh, yeah, okay, I do agree. Yes, maybe we should turn it back on. But everybody in my locality is against it. So I'm very sorry, but I have to listen to them. Even though I personally, I agree with you, Prime Minister, whoever, that I think we do need to turn it back on. But nobody's saying yes, so what am I supposed to do? I can't, you know? So it's kind of like a people power situation that's happening. So something like my book that gives an individual Japanese person a lot of confidence in the face of globalization, or something like another book by somebody else, by a Japanese entrepreneur, that specifies which areas need to be globalized, or something like TPP, where there's a big discussion going on about whether Japan should join and the U.S. is kind of against Japan joining and things. You know, it's going to be a whole bunch of things that sort of push it from around, you know, to try to make it happen. It's not going to be, I don't think it's going to be one thing, but I think the earthquake was a really big trigger for all of this.
Yeah, like I used to say, a wake-up call for many people in Japan to, I think, kind of realize that, hey, their government may not always be honest with them. Some of these large companies may not be upfront with them all the time.
I don't know if it's like a suspicion of maybe they're not being honest. It's more like maybe they don't really know what's going on. And I mean, I think that's pretty probably closer to the truth.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I was just as worried as everybody else after the earthquake and this whole nuclear cloud thing might be coming over. We might be eating cesium right now. I mean, you don't know, right?
Right.
But I felt like they were doing their best. But then at the same time, maybe they don't really know what's going on. So thanks to Facebook, thanks to all these other methods where you can get information, people were sharing information about trains being stopped at this station on this day and, you know, stuff. I feel like, I mean, you know, Japan has a huge advantage here because when people come together in Japan, they really come together.
Right.
When you talk about people power, you don't have to gather in some square and have a demonstration in Japan.
Right.
It happens. Like, I can't explain how, and you'll never figure it out. And I don't think a Japanese person understands it either. There's something here where people are connected in a way that doesn't happen in other countries because of the fact that it's an island nation, right?
Right.
Maybe it might happen in Ireland. I've heard some interesting comparisons between Japan and Ireland because Ireland has always been invaded. So you've heard, I think Leonardo DiCaprio said that Irish people in one of the movies, that Irish people are the only people on the face of the earth that can't be psychoanalyzed because they're so paranoid because they've been invaded so many times over such a long time that it's always sort of like, okay, what could happen today? You know, what could happen? So they have to like constantly be changing their personality, and it's an island nation, right?
Right.
In the same way, Japan has also been always an island nation and probably had lots of influence from the outside over the years, right? So it's sort of like, being isolated and having those 200 years of peace around the Tokugawa shogunate and having the sakoku where they didn't allow people in created this kind of continuity that doesn't exist anywhere else. So you do not need to call people to Hibiya Park to have them gather and say we're against this. All you have to do is have a general mode of anti-nuclear. And then all of a sudden, uh-oh, none of the 56 plants are going to be turned back on, right?
Right, right, right. Yeah, it is interesting that here, you know, the revolution doesn't have to, like you said, doesn't have to be in a square. It doesn't have to be on the street. I mean, it's just kind of this mentality or this communique goes throughout the whole country and everyone seems to fall in line with it.
Yep.
Tell me about your book. The English title is called 33 More Reasons to Be Proud.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the Japanese title?
The Japanese title is 日本人が世界に誇れる33のこと.
Okay. And where did the idea for this book come from?
It originated, I was writing for, I was asked to write for a magazine by a former advertising head of Recruit, like a senpai of mine. And he wanted to write a magazine that people actually read. Because as you know, everybody can download things, people get information from the computer. But, you know, we still do need hard media. And he wanted something that people actually sit down and read, like a book that's a monthly publication, like Harper's Review or something. And so he asked me, he said, he got a whole bunch of different people together to write about different topics. Kind of like a positive sort of view, you know, let's think positive kind of line to the magazine. And he said, Ruthie, could you write some good things about Japanese people? And I'm like, are you kidding me? If you gave me all the paper in the entire world, I still wouldn't have enough paper to write good things about all the good things I think about Japanese people. And he looked at me and he's like, are you kidding? And I said, no. I said, Higashi-san, don't you know about all the wonderful that's here in this country? And he's like, yeah, right, please write. So I started writing, and I wrote 46 articles, you know, over 2.5 years. And then, just as a present to me, he put it together in like a little pamphlet. And I was always writing for the magazine, so I never really got direct feedback from people that were reading them. Okay, so he made a little booklet with half of the articles in like a little booklet for me. So he made like 1,000 of those. So I just thought, well, that's nice because I do want to get this message to as many people as possible because I'm really writing about things that Japanese people do unconsciously and they don't realize how great it is and it's best practice that should be taught the entire world, you know? So started passing that out, and then one of my partners took it to a publishing company called Asa Publishing, and he passed it to the publisher, the president, and the president wrote me a mail that night and said, this message is exactly what Japanese people really need right now, so we're going to make this a book. And that was the end of February, and then May 17th, it's out in the stores. So it was like very super speed publishing.
Right.
And it sold out already.
Wow, really? That's great.
So they made 6,000 copies, and those already sold out. So two nights ago, they decided to print more.
Right.
So hopefully it'll get to a lot of people. And I've gotten every single person who says anything will say, thank you for the encouragement. You made me feel more confident. Thank you for these words. You know, I haven't gotten anything bad about it.
Can you explain to us then what the title means? I don't know if the English translation works really well for the Japanese title, but 33 more reasons to be proud. Proud of what? Proud of being Japanese? Proud of what they've accomplished? What are the 33 reasons?
Well, I specifically left that out, and I specifically used the word more. Even though it doesn't say more in the Japanese title.
Right.
Because I believe that obviously there's not just 33. If you wanted me to write 33 great things about the U.S., I would have a hard time, you know, narrowing it down to 33 because there's millions of great things about the U.S. But in this one, you know, for each of these articles, it took me about 2 weeks to think about because it comes from a small trigger. So I hardly hear horns in Japan in the road when I'm walking down the street. You hardly hear people beeping. But when I go to India, when I go to China, when I go to Hawaii, when I go to New York, you hear much more beeping. Okay. So that makes me think, why? Why is that? So I think and think and think and think and think and think about this. And then I get to the concept of the whole gaman culture in Japan, of patience, self-control. Gaman is sometimes taken in a negative way, but gaman is also a very positive thing. So even though the light has changed and I'm in a rush and I want to go, if the person in front of me in the U.S., it's like, I'm in a rush, I want to go, why is this guy taking so long? Beep, right?
Right.
If I'm in Japan, I'm like, I'm in a rush, I want to go. But wait a minute. What if the person in front of me is an older elderly person that takes a little bit more time to start? Or what if the person is like looking down and not hasn't seen the light? Or it's an immediate thought process that comes into the mind. So a Japanese person's immediate reaction is, I'm in a rush, I want to go, hurry up, boom. It's more like, I'm in a rush, I want to go, okay, but it might be an elderly person. Maybe they haven't noticed the light yet. If I beat my horn, they might get surprised and it might cause like an accident. If I beat my horn and the people next to me are having a conversation, I might interrupt their conversation. It'll make people on the street get surprised. You know, let me just wait a minute here, see what happens. And then, as you've seen probably many times, the two cars on the side of the one in front of me move. And then that person in front is like, oh, gomen, gomen, and moves, right? Mm. Now, if the light changes and it's like 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and still they don't move, then a Japanese person will be like, beep, like, you know, it changed, you know, like that, right?
Right.
This gets me to the other point of the time that I just made you wait, right? We, from the West, at least myself, are not used to the amount of silence that is included in conversation here in Japan. It's a much longer silence. And that also comes from the whole deep thinking. I mean, I write about it very in depth in my book, but it's people are averse to answering quickly here because people have a stronger sense of responsibility to their answer than we do, than I do, than I did. I'm trying to change. So in the U.S., we would say, oh, yeah, you know, we can do that. I would say that quickly. In Japan, if you say, oh, yeah, I can do that, you really have to do it. Like, there's a very strong sense of responsibility towards a yes here. So the reason you don't get yes that much is because if you do get a yes, they're going to do it.
Right.
And they're going to make sure they can do it before they even say yes. So the whole point about waiting and silence, you know, this is also another part of Japanese language that people have to learn, the unspoken part. Sometimes the unspoken part of the language is more important than the spoken side in Japan. So, you know, I bring up it's basically 33 of these topics based on specific examples and then why I think that is and why I think it's so great. And why I think this needs to be included in all the boardrooms around the entire planet, you know?
Reading through some of the reviews on Amazon, everyone seems to have a lot of positive things to say about the book. What has been the Japanese people's reaction to your book, to you?
The first reaction I received was, thank you, right? The second reaction I received was, these are things that we Japanese cannot forget. I've gotten a lot of that. These are things that we felt almost like we were starting to lose. But Ruth has pointed out that these, and it's true, that these are parts of our culture we cannot lose. Last week, the 22nd was the actual sales day for the book. It actually started arriving in the stores around the 17th of May, but the 22nd was the official date. Just by chance, one of the guys who runs the second most popular blog in Japan was in a bookstore in Osaka. I didn't even know him. And he saw the title of the book and he pulled it out and he really liked it. The part that he liked was when I talk about how many ways you can say thank you in Japanese. There's so many ways you can say thank you, and how that is such a insight into the culture. Because when, if you think about it, if you're always thinking about how to say thank you, where is your focus? Think about that. Your focus is not on yourself. If you're always thinking about how to say thank you, your focus is on the other person. How do I respond to what this person said to me in a nice way that shows I'm grateful? Or how do I give back a present? I received something, but now I need to, you know, respond in kind, and what should I get? And the entire focus is on another person, not on yourself. So that's something all of us need to learn, because we have a tendency to focus on why is someone not appreciative of what I did for them? Whereas in Japan, it's like, how can I be more appreciative for what that person did to me and make sure that it communicates with them where they don't feel like they have to respond in kind? You know what I mean? It's like a constant game, right? So he wrote up that section, just that little section of my book on his blog. And I received a mail in the morning on the way to work in the train. And it said, I saw your a little bit of your book on Ippun de Kando, which is the name of the blog, Ippun de Kando, 1 minute of being moved is basically kando, right? Being moved. And I said, oh, cool. You know, somebody wrote me up on their blog. Awesome. I was so happy about that. But then I was a little scared because I don't know what they wrote, right? So I went into the office. I'm checking my business cards and things. And then I'm like, okay, I'm going to be brave and I'm going to check the blog and see what they wrote, you know? So I opened up the blog, and honestly, I thought I was making a mistake because it had been noted on the blog at 8 in the morning. I'm checking it at 10 in the morning, and it's already 3,183 people are like in 2 hours.
Wow.
And then every time I push, you know, refresh, it would increase by 500 people.
Wow.
So in 1 day, I got 12,000 likes on this one little part of the book from that blog. Wow. So even now I feel like emotional, because you feel like so many people in Japan who need this message are getting it. You know, it's a very moving thing. And yeah, so everybody's feeling like, you know, thank you for pointing this out. Thank you for helping us feel confident about us, you know.
You mentioned just briefly that you were a little bit worried about checking the blog. Were you worried at all about the reaction that you might get from your book before you published it?
Well, in general, I'm always worried about everything, but I didn't think that I would get such a negative reaction, because I got good reactions about the pamphlet that I had been passing out.
Right.
I was a little bit, I am still a little bit worried that some people might think I'm comparing the U.S. in a bad way, which I'm not. It's just basically, these are things that I didn't experience before. So, you know, because of that indirectly, it means that that is, doesn't exist, at least in my experience in the U.S. So one person gave an interesting review. They said, I flipped through the book in the bookstore and there was no data, no statistics, no nothing. So I was thinking, okay, this is just a good way to, you know, like spend some time, like use extra time or whatever, right? And then he went home after buying the book and he read it and he realized that it's so deep that it can't be statistically described. There is no way to statistically describe what I'm saying. It's because of personal experience in both cultures. And it seems that I've kind of hit it on the head with these three, with these 33.
I can't wait to read it. Is there an English version coming out? Because it's going to be years before my Japanese is that level that I can read it.
Well, I mean, you know, that was another thing that surprised me. I took it to the ACCJ because I'm a member over there, the American Chamber of Commerce. And I showed it to my friend. And he's like, so who did you get to translate this for you? And I'm like, no one. I wrote it. I wrote it in Japanese. And he's like, not. I guess. So I realized that writing something in your second language and getting published in that country is a pretty big deal, isn't it? So, but I always was writing this for the Japanese audience, not for foreigners, because I wanted Japanese people to realize all the great and wonderful things that they have here. So when it comes out in English, which I'm hoping in the next 1 or 2 years I can do, I want to write it now for the foreign audience. I want to write on the same topics, because there's some jokes and stuff in the book that it just somebody wouldn't get if it was in English.
Right.
So I want to write it in a funny way, in a fun way, same topics to a foreign audience.
You have a book signing coming up, is that right? Or I'm sorry, a book launch coming up.
Yeah, I have a launch party on the 16th of June. So if anybody wants to come, please come. It'll be at the Civic Center in Bunkyoku near Korakuen Station. And if you go on Facebook or if you access something called, it's called the HRM Association. HRM Association is the sponsor of this.
Do people have to register for the
book launch? Yeah, you have to register in advance, and there's like a there's a fee because it includes dinner. So I think it's like 6,000 yen or something. But it'll be an interesting group of people there. It should be fun.
I'm just trying to look here. Does the HRM have a website that people can go to?
Yeah, it's let me see what it is. It's called hrm.or.jp.
Say that then. So if you are interested in seeing Ruth-san in person, I take it you're going to be doing a reading from your book?
Yeah, and actually, I mean, this is kind of secret, but I'm going to tell everybody. I'm not very good at saying thank you in front of people because I always cry. So I decided that instead of a thank you, I'm going to do a hula for everybody.
Really?
Yeah, because it's a very good way of expressing gratitude.
Well, you were a cheerleader, right?
Yeah, and being from Hawaii and stuff.
Right, right. So if you want to see Ruth-san do the hula, visit the HRM Society, and I'll post a link to that from my website at tokyopodcast.com. Thank you, Ruth. Thanks for coming on the show. I am very excited to hear about your book and all your success here in Japan.
And I'm very grateful to you for supporting me like this, and I really appreciate it.
No problem.
I just want to tell everybody that even if you yourself can't read the book, Garen's, Balbarens, as we would say in Hawaii, Garen's, Balbarens, any of your Japanese friends or your in-laws or anybody will love it. So please use it as a present or give it to them. It really helps Japanese people feel encouraged.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Thanks, Ruth.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thanks again to Ruth for coming on the show and telling us a little bit more about her book, which is available in bookstores throughout Japan as well as online through Amazon. The book is currently only available in Japanese, but as Ruth mentioned, she might do an English version at a later date. However, if you're looking for a gift for your Japanese friend, I would highly recommend giving Ruth's book. The title of the book is Nihonjin ga Sekai ni Hokoreru 33 no Koto. And the English version of that translates to 33 More Reasons to be Proud. If you want to hear Ruth do a reading from her book, check out her book launch, which is on June 16th. And you can register for that through the HRM website, which is hrm.or.jp. And there's I believe it's a 6,000 yen fee for dinner, books launch, and you get to see Ruth do the hula. That's definitely money well spent. Anyways, that's it. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Anthony Joe, and bye-bye. Thank you.